Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Grenville Strategic Royalties' first quarter 2016 financial results conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Following the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Instructions will be provided at that time for you to queue up for questions. If anyone has difficulties hearing the conference, you may press star zero for operator assistance at any time. I would like to remind everyone that today's discussions may contain forward-looking statements that reflect current views with respect to future events. Any such statements are subject to risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results to differ materially from those projected in the forward-looking statements. For more information on Grenville's risks and uncertainties related to these forward-looking statements, please refer to the company's Management and Information Circular dated May 24, 2016, which is available on SEDAR. Today's call is being recorded on May 27, 2016. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Mr. Steve Perry, Chief Executive Officer of Grenville Strategic Royalty. Please go ahead, Mr. Perry.
Good morning, and thank you for participating in today's call. I am joined today by Donica Rao, our Chief Financial Officer. During this call, we're going to make reference to two slides in our new Q1 presentation deck, which is found on the financial results site of our website. This deck will provide some additional color in our results, as requested by a number of our shareholders. We're 1 month into our review of the business, subsequent to the Q4 announcement. Since then, we have constructed a diversified portfolio across denominations, sectors, and investment types. We continue to build our strong core investments that form the bulk of our portfolio by working with management teams to strengthen their financial position and achieve their growth objectives. Last quarter, we spoke about the softness in the market, and we mentioned our focus would be shifting to our winners that can expand their revenue streams. We've made progress on that front. We've made the hard decisions about fair market value on investments and investments where we can identify gains. It's a fundamental change in how our work process is going forward, and we've made progress in that regard. Our Q1 results that we announced this morning are broadly in line with our outlook. Royalty payment income remains strong in Q1 at $2.5 million. Adjusted EBITDA was also strong at $1.6 million. Free cash flows, net of short-term timing differences, we're in line with our expectation. Working capital timing differences and the team bonuses for 2015 led to negative cash flow in Q1 of $639,000. Taking into account both the $885,000 in sales taxes recoverable and royalty payments that were made after March 31 and the $500,000 in bonuses for 15 made during the quarter, those are the differences in those numbers. Free cash flow generation from the portfolio remains positive on a go-forward basis. The sales taxes and royalty payments received post-quarter end will be recorded in Q2 figures. However, the headwinds continue in the broader SME market with tight credit in both U.S. and Canada. While much of the market volatility in Q1 was related to the oil prices, it affected most sectors of the economy, particularly in Canada. In general, the stock markets have corrected since, but there have been meaningful negative economic impacts on SMEs, which lag far behind the stock market. While it has only been 30 days since our last call, work on our portfolio is generating some important improvements. With respect to our portfolio, Q1 2016, we recorded $2.9 million, related to an unrealized loss from the change in fair value of the royalty agreements acquired. This is slightly higher than forecast, but again in line with our conservative approach to the balance sheet. This means that in the past 30 days, we've reported two quarters in which we've recorded a total of $8 million in fair value changes. It demonstrates the aggressive approach we're taking with respect to our balance sheet. This level of transparency and quality of disclosure is a direct result of the decision to transfer to IFRS 9. It's important to note that these changes impacted our top-line revenue under IFRS 9. The IFRS 9 accounting standard provides us with the ability to conservatively record off-target or loss investments at fair value, while also capturing the upside of investments that have been bought out or are performing above target. It's an approach that is more closely aligned with to how we evaluate the portfolio, and we believe it gives investors a much clearer view of how the portfolio is actually performing than the book method value method used previously. We recommend reviewing slide 6 on our Q1 presentation deck for a simple comparison of IFRS 9 to our previous accounting treatment. Since the beginning of 2016, we have intentionally slowed our rate of investment and revised our investment strategy. We deployed $5.8 million since the start of the year, all of which was in follow-on investments. These were primarily strategic or defensive in nature. Over time, strategic defensive investments are an important strategy for maximizing a return. The average royalty per million invested was $217,000 in March 2016. We expect the average royalty per million in April of 2016 will be in the range of $160,000 to $180,000 due to our decision not to accrue unpaid royalties owed by CompGen by virtue of its current performance. We would anticipate returning the CompGen royalty to full accrual should their situation improve. Looking at portfolio performance, as of the end of Q1, 82% of the portfolio was performing on target or better, and 18% of the portfolio was performing off target or at a loss. This type of portfolio performance is absolutely consistent with what we originally envisaged when we formed the business. Now, in response to a number of requests from shareholders, we're providing additional background on the quarter on the company website with the new quarterly presentation. In particular, I want to refer to page 10 of the deck, which presents portfolio IRR. This is an IRR calculation based on all royalty, interest, and buyout income of all and all investments, plus the fair value of the portfolio at quarter end. As shown, the portfolio is currently tracking to 23% IRR since inception. We believe this is the correct way to view the portfolio's performance based on the perpetual nature of royalties. As we have frequently commented, income from a long-term royalty fund invested in SMEs will, by its nature, have short-term fluctuations. Our combination of a 25% pricing strategy combined with the buyout formula designed to enhance the 25% rate provides significant returns to offset the expected losses in such a portfolio. This IRR fully takes into account the 18% off-target and loss investments in the portfolio. Earlier this month, the board approved a dividend of 5 cents per share on an annualized basis. This represents a reduction of 2 cents. The 5 cent level is commensurate with the dividend we originally implemented last year. The 5 cent level is one part of a broader strategy to achieve a sustainable dividend in the near term. At the same time, we are also managing our investments and reducing our cost structure internally. A great deal of our value proposition to portfolio companies is to help them achieve the next stage of their growth, and we are actively engaged in doing that with some of our best companies today. It's not that these companies won't succeed on their own, but combined, we can do better, and that's why our capital is valuable. In that sense, we're back to basics. We're providing capital and expertise to grow businesses faster. That work was a priority for us in this quarter. In the 30 days since taking over my new role, we're also identifying areas to reduce costs at Grenville. We expect to see some of the impact of these cost reductions in Q2 2016, with a greater impact in Q3. Taken together, these three actions are the key components of achieving a sustainable dividend. We are making progress, and we have a high level of confidence that we possess the tools to deliver strong shareholder returns. And with that, I'll turn the call over to Donica to review the financial results. Donica?
Thank you, Steve. As Steve mentioned, we have adopted IFRS 9 as our accounting standard as of January 1, 2015. Under IFRS 9, metrics like royalty payment income, adjusted EBITDA, and free cash flow will be more suitable measures for tracking the economic performance of the company than revenue. For a full description of the impact of adopting IFRS 9, please see Management's Discussion and Analysis and Financial Statements filed on SEDAR, available at www.sedar.com. Royalty payment income was $2.5 million in Q1 2016, a 67% increase compared to $1.5 million in the same period in 2015. The increase was primarily as a result of $32.7 million in new royalty agreements acquired since the end of March 2015. We recorded adjusted EBITDA of $1.6 million in Q1 2016, a 50% increase compared to $1.1 million in the same period last year. The increase was due to the increased royalty payment income of $1 million, partially offset by the increase in operating expenses of $538,000, which I'll address in a moment. Revenue, including non-cash unrealized losses of $5.5 million, was negative $2.8 million in Q1 2016. Revenue was impacted by a non-cash $2.9 million unrealized loss in the fair value of the royalty agreements acquired and promissory notes receivable, and a $2.5 million in unrealized loss in foreign exchange. Of the $2.9 million recorded as an unrealized loss from the change in the fair value, $2.3 million related to the $5.8 million in follow-on investments we made since January 1, 2016. Based on information available as of May 26, 2016, we do not expect any unrealized loss will be needed on these follow-on investments in Q2 2016. The foreign exchange loss was a result of agreements and notes denominated in US dollars and a Canadian exchange rate fluctuation from 1.384 per US dollar as of December 31, 2015 to 1.2987 as of March 31, 2016. Revenue was $2.8 million in Q1 2015, but included a non-cash unrealized foreign exchange gain of $1.2 million. Total operating expenses was $1.05 million for Q1 2016, compared to $521,000 for the same period last year. The change is primarily due to increased salary and benefits related to a new managing director, an additional investment team member, and a third-party executive compensation review that resulted in an increase for existing members, as well as one-time consultancy expenses for the IFRS 9 conversion and portfolio fair value valuation reports. Looking ahead, we estimate operating expenses to run between $200,000 to $220,000 on a monthly basis by the end of 2016, once all cost reduction initiatives have been deployed. Free cash flow was negative $639,000 in Q1 2016, compared to a positive $166,000 in the same period last year. The change was due to short-term timing differences, specifically sales tax recoverable of $703,000, which was received in May 2016, and royalty payments due in March and were received in early Q2 of $182,000. Free cash flow was also impacted by $500,000 in bonus payments made in Q1 2016 relating to 2015. No payments were made in the same period last year. Management is confident in the ability of the business and the core holdings to generate substantial free cash flow on an ongoing basis. During Q1 2016, we made aggregate payments of $1.8 million in dividends. From April 1 to May 26, 2016, we have made $1.25 million in dividend payments. As at March 31, 2016, the loans and royalty agreements acquired were $62.5 million, an increase from $29.9 million at the same point in 2015. Working capital was $13.9 million, and our cash position was $10.1 million. I will now turn it back over to Steve for his closing thoughts.
Thanks, Tanaka. Since our inception, we've invested $63 million and recorded $28 million of cash inflows, consisting of contract buyouts, royalty payment income, and interest income. We continue to see considerable growth in the medium to long term for our royalty-based financing product as SMEs search for growth capital alternatives to traditional equity or debt. While our view for 2016 is unchanged since our last call, we remain very bullish on our business model. The core holdings within our portfolio continue to provide robust returns even during this period of market instability in the SME market. We have a proven business model that demonstrates the value in using a 12% cost of capital to arbitrage investments at a 25% pricing level, which is unique in the royalty industry. As we continue to prudently invest, our durable cash flows from the core of our portfolio will continue to grow. I would like to thank our shareholders for the commitment and patience they've demonstrated as we execute on our strategy. Based on my evaluation since taking over this role, I believe we have the resources and the team in place required to continue growing a sustainable, profitable business for our shareholders. At this time, we would now like to take your questions. Operator?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Again, that's star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from Trevor Johnson with NBC. Please go ahead.
Hey, morning, gentlemen.
Morning, Trevor.
Just looking at, in terms of ComGen, just curious if what they need to do to kind of get back on track, if there's a blueprint in place to kind of get the accruals back in place, and maybe just a few other, any other talking points you think are relevant to that business kind of getting back on track.
Sure. We spent a great deal of team time on ComGen over the quarter, and in fact, they've had made fairly considerable progress on achieving cash flow, or I should say operating break-even in the business. That's been the result of some pretty significant cost-cutting and basically stabilizing their business. I think they've done a great job in doing so. That company still has really the largest portfolio of potential new business of any company we've invested in, and it remains the reason why we were so bullish about the deal originally. The next steps for them really are to see a few of these very large orders, which have initial payments that go into the millions of dollars, close and provide them with the capital to both repay our credit line, which is part of our investment in this company, and go on to pay the ongoing dividend. That's the ongoing royalty payment. Their progress has been significant, but we're still sufficiently concerned that we've taken a very conservative approach to their business in terms of non-accrual of the royalty stream.
Yeah. And when you're doing the calc for the average royalty per million deployed, is the credit line interest income included in that calc?
Yes, Trevor.
That would be included in that?
It is, but just to be clear, that for up to the end of March, it was included, but from in the April number that we've given guidance on, we haven't included any accrual for any income either on the credit line or the royalty agreement.
And
okay,
that change really occurred because it wasn't material prior to that quarter. We made the change when it started to appear that would be a more appropriate way to quote the numbers.
Correct.
It did not have a historical effect on our numbers.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah, that was my next question. Was just the delta seemed to be kind of sharp going from your 220s down to the 160, 180 guidance. So is it fair to say that in the abs, like, I know it's hard for you to forecast what the rest of the portfolio does, but on a run rate basis, without accruals from CompGen, the run rate monthly royalty revenue, would you say roughly that 160 to 180 number?
Correct.
Okay.
It's a very, very important point, Trevor. We are conservatively quoting just the royalty income with that number. A huge part of our story is the contract buyouts, which are not included. If you add those in, then we are significantly performing at a higher level. I believe it was in the 300s last month based on inclusion of the contract buyouts. So this quarter, you know, you have a quarter in which you're catching us in between contract buyouts, and when one or two of our companies are experiencing some headwinds, and we're taking on board some fairly important year-end type costs like the bonuses. So you're getting sort of a cumulative effect going on here. We think it's extremely important, and we hope this is one of the main messages taken away from the call, that we look at how the company performs as a series of long-dated perpetual royalties on a longer-term basis. If you were to take the blowout quarter of 2015 year-end, or you were to take this quarter and use that as a metric, we would not appropriately present the company. It's that longer-term benefit of having these kind of long-term contracts that really has the value and where we think the important numbers are. That's why we put in the presentation deck the IRR calculation, which shows you from inception exactly how we're performing, which we think is pretty spectacular.
Yeah.
The other thing I'd just add to that, Trevor, is that, you know, we do want to emphasize that still our pricing level is still at 25%. Do not want to give the impression that in any new investments it's at 160,000, 180,000. Our pricing levels will remain at 25%.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I mean, I get the IRR from like the legacy IRR and that reflecting. I mean, the challenge is just trying to predict the buyouts, and from our end, it's going to be tough to give you credit for that. I mean, I realize you did very successful, and that was a big part of your wins in the past, but maybe just give us any sense of granularity on, is there still an appetite for buyouts going forward, and is that something that you would expect for the later of this year, if you can provide any data on that?
We've been discussing that in-house in the last few days. If you look at our portfolio today, the first thing we would say is the portfolio today looks exactly like the portfolio last year, ex buyouts. It looks very similar, and we see a series of companies today that look very similar to the companies that became our buyouts last year. They're in various stages of conversations with us. Their businesses are growing and in ways that are very positive, and you can see that it will simply be possible for them to find lower cost capital in the near term. And when that happens, typically the first thing they do is say, well, we'd like to start talking about a buyout. So we think our portfolio has the same potential to generate those buyouts this year that it did last year. We think it's a fundamental characteristic of the deal structure we use.
Yeah. That's good. Thanks, guys. I'll hop back in the queue.
Thanks, Trevor.
Your next question comes from Jeff Fenwick with Cormark Securities. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Just some follow-ups here on some of the other names in the portfolio. I guess the one I look at here is Lattice, and you've been extending incremental funding to them as they go through this RTO process, and they're not. It doesn't look like they're paying you now right now either. So can you give us a bit of an update on where that stands in the RTO process?
Sure. Lattice is, in fact, public and is traded on the TSXV. They completed a financing of, I believe it was about $1.3 million at the end of last year, and they continue to find additional capital in the marketplace, which they've announced. We're going to see this happen from time to time where we have companies that are sufficiently robust to go public, but will need some time to generate the kinds of revenues that pay us our full dividend. This is one of our strategies where we think, an advantage over a lot of firms. We have expertise in-house in helping companies with the go public transaction. We have sources of capital we can point them to that get them that next round of capital. Sometimes it'll mean that to make those financings work, we take a holiday on payments while all pieces of the puzzle come together. That is fully built into the off-target part of our model, which we anticipated when we set up the structure. Again, we would sort of make the point, you always have to look at the underperforming and the overperforming buckets of our company together. We believe firmly that, you know, the math in this is simply in our favor. You can never lose more than one extra money on the downside. Our buyout structure gives us the chance for two or more extra money. Remember that that structure is fairly unique. It says they pay us the greater of two times our capital plus whatever else they've paid us, plus an opportunity to participate at what we call equivalent equity value. So a company that sells for many multiples of its original share price could actually pay us an 8 or 10x return. It's quite remarkable. We saw the value in companies like Above Security, where they started out on the downside, on the off-target side, but our risk-reward analysis there was continue to fund, take a holiday on royalties for a short period of time. That then turned into our biggest exit at $6 million. We would see Lattice very much the same. This is a period where we're making what we think are intelligent risk-reward decisions. They're finding additional capital. We're betting that they will, in the near to medium term, find ways to continue funding, put us back on royalty stream, and then eventually exit through a buyout structure.
And then are you, so on that one, you feel confident that things are going to turn out well, and so you're continuing to accrue that as revenue, even though you're not getting paid in cash. Is that true?
No, in relation to Lattice, we've taken a conservative approach, and we are not accruing any revenue for the Lattice investment at this moment in time. However, I mean, if things change, you know, we would then start to accrue the royalty income.
And then, you know, I just look at these follow-ons that you're doing, and I look at the weighted average royalty rate here. I'm assuming, you know, the two go together, where you're starting to push up the overall royalty rate from the company on revenue up over 4%. And I know, you know, historically, I think you've been targeting kind of 1-3 or 1-4, and you know, you didn't want to go too much above that because it felt like you started to put risk or more pressure on these companies to be able to pay you. So, you know, I guess, you know, you just How do you balance that when you're looking at these follow-on things? Are you in a way protecting yourself, but maybe you're going to end up overloading these companies with debt as well and get yourself sort of backed into a corner?
Right. So that is a very important part of managing an SME portfolio. Annie Terrio did a very significant led a big piece of work here in house looking at our deal strategy, and one of the conclusions that came out of that work was that you can simply fix that problem by investing less in earlier rounds of the company. And that's a piece of what I think our ongoing strategy will be. We'll tend to invest smaller amounts earlier. That just naturally brings down that average number and helps with the overall plan. Importantly, the interaction between the rate we charge and the minimum in the contract is very important. Sometimes the fact that it's a big royalty number isn't very important. If we've picked up a company with lower revenues, it's actually the minimum that counts, and that's the number that we are actually dealing with in the company. Overall, though, it's really about setting the size of our investments to be the right size for the company, ultimately finding them lower cost capital as we move forward, and that's how you generate a buyout structure to happen.
And then maybe just one last one here on the last quarter when you came out, there was a discussion around this concept of sustainability of the dividend. You did lower the dividend, obviously, but you know, how do you view that phrase of sustainable when we look at it here? Because you have some of these investments going through a transition period. You're going to have, I guess, some cash come in the door that was delayed in Q1, but you're also going to have, I think, about $675,000 of severance there as well. So it looks like maybe even Q2 you might be a little pressured in terms of the payout ratio versus the dividend here. You know, how are you reviewing that on an ongoing basis? Are you looking at it at run rate today, or is there some optimism around some of these things working out over the next couple of quarters?
The board basically makes a decision on the dividend rate every month. The one that we made in the past quarter was based on 2 weeks of very intensive work looking at all aspects of the business. Going forward, that's what will happen every month. By sustainability, what we mean is we have a dividend based only on royalty income that can be paid and retain the cash flow and the cash balances in the business. Obviously, we have more than sufficient capital on our balance sheet, and we have always had that condition. So it's not a case of being unable to pay it. It's what, in the best judgment of management and the board, generates a safe dividend that people can be comfortable with going forward. Ultimately, it's a decision about best interest of shareholders. It's a tough, hard call you make every month, and we decided this last month to basically go to the level we've been at for most of 2015, a level which is still, in our estimation, a pretty robust dividend for a small company.
Okay, thank you. That's it for me.
Thank you.
And again, if you would like to ask a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from David Quezada with Raymond James. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Morning, guys.
Good morning.
Just a quick question on capital deployment, potentially new royalty investments. I apologize if you already discussed this. I'm joining the call a little late. Can you talk about how you're thinking about that now that you're into your review here, and then maybe just some commentary on how your pipeline looks and the kind of deals you're looking at today?
Sure. So we've intentionally taken a bit of a pause on new investments for the past number of months, and that's really been to evaluate the 75 investments, 31 companies that we've already invested in. That database is extremely valuable, and it tells a very interesting story. So again, the work that Annie's been leading in the past number of months has really pointed to a number of trends that, having identified them, we can now sort of restart our outbound investment process. I won't go into great detail about this. Some of it is additional information is on that presentation on the website. One of the keys that we would see is that if you look at our buyouts, they're almost always in companies with a technology component. They're software businesses. They're IT-related investments. And so there's a sense that that should be an area of focus going forward. If you think about the conversations we tend to have about companies in trouble, they tend to be more industrial. So we see a shift towards the more technology-focused end of the spectrum. Doesn't mean we would never do an industrial deal, but it will just tend to be more of a trend in that direction. So that's kind of been the key piece of it. In terms of going forward, we are seeing extremely robust deal flow. One of the things, once you change your model like this, when you start to look at more selective deal flow requirements, you can then start a proactive effort to work in the marketplace in those areas. And so if you're going to go look for technology investments, one of the things you do is you start looking in places like Silicon Valley. So in the past quarter, we've had Rob McLarty join us, working with the team on as one of our principal investors out of Silicon Valley. That's going to help with deal flow down there. That's the kind of response that we are making to the identification of these sectoral advantages. One of the really neat things about our database is when you can take and slice and dice it on the basis of sector. So if you take our total portfolio and cut out the industrials and look at the return you would get if you were to focus on the more technology-centric companies, you see a pretty significant improvement in our IRR. So that's pretty good evidence that we should start looking there and start generating deal flow in that marketplace. I think there's just no question there's more than sufficient deal flow out there for Grenville at any size we would choose to run the company at in the near to medium term. So it's just not been one of the governors on our business. This has been much more driven by an internal desire to really understand our business, pick the high points where we get the best return, then go back out and seek those higher return investments.
Okay, great. That's helpful. Thanks. That's all I had for now.
Thanks, David.
And once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. And there are no further questions at this time. I will now turn the call back over to Mr. Perry. My apologies.
I believe there may be a call from Mark Charbon.
Yes, we do have a question from the line of Mark Charbon with Laurentian Bank Securities. Please go ahead.
Morning. Thanks for taking the call. Quickly, of your 25 investees, how many do you expect that will have financing requirements in the next 12 months, and how many are free cash flow positive?
I don't have that exact number for you today. I'd have to go back and actually do the math to know that number exactly. It also varies. A lot of these companies go in and out of cash flow positive. So if you deal with a company that has a software product as an example, Mark, they can be cash flow positive on any given month and decide, well, we're going to develop, Rev 2 of our program. We're going to spend $600,000 on that work. And we're going to go and finance it. So it isn't so binary as they make money or they don't make money. It's more a case of are they able to capitalize the business or not. That's actually another one of the important learnings out of the study, was that just because a company has a positive debt service coverage ratio when you invest does not necessarily mean it will going forward. A much more important criteria based on the math of our database is companies that have the capability of raising capital when they need it. It is just simply true. It's harder to raise money on Canadian companies than U.S. companies. We have companies in the industrial sector where, if you're doing a deal and somebody making, a hard goods product, how many investors out there really want to be invested in that sector? And you'll find that it's not a very large number of investors. On the other hand, if it's a company with a great software product, it may not be growing fast enough for the VC community, but it's growing fast enough where we make a return and a venture debt lender or a angel investor looking for a significant return at a smaller level can really make a case for making that investment. So our criteria for picking is changing fairly significantly to that capability to finance component. When you look at somebody like Ray Chahada, who ran Above Security, Ray had, I would guess, 10 or 15 different sources of capital in that deal before he sold to Hitachi. At times, he couldn't pay our royalty, and he would have been listed as an off-target company. But at the end of the day, that was our largest investment. The assessment we have to make is whether companies have that transition capability to go forward. And so it's a different way, I would say, of looking at the importance of free cash flow in a small business.
Okay, so setting aside free cash flow, can you estimate the number of the companies that you believe will have financing requirements in the next 6 to 12 months, or is the answer pretty much the same as free cash flow?
It's just very hard to judge because you don't know where companies will decide to go with respect to their business. Let me give you an example because it's in the public domain. Lattice Biologics. That was a company that when we invested had a very simple allographic products business that sold to hospitals. We understood that business and went forward. They decided to go public because they developed internal stem cell research capability and what I would call pure biotech opportunity that was much larger than we originally perceived. And it changed the way they invested or put forward capital. It just changed over the course of a matter of weeks. We've since seen them announce a major contract with Sunnybrook Hospital in Canada. They're a Phoenix-based organization. They've really changed how their business model works. So it's more volatile than I think I'm, to give you a really clean X companies in the portfolio. Maybe I could say to you that on a typical year, probably 30% of our companies, something like that, would finance. Might be ballpark number, but it's so variable. It's like, I'm not sure that stat has much meaning for you because it's such a volatile number.
All right, that's it for me. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
And there are no further questions at this time. Mr. Perry, I'll turn the call back over to you.
Well, I really appreciate everyone's time this morning, and I would encourage everyone to have a look at that, the fact sheet and the presentation on the website. It does provide additional color. We're, of course, available to answer any questions you have on the information provided there, and our objective is, by the time we're at Q2, we've got a really clear understanding for the whole community about our shareholder base for how we're running the business and what we see as the opportunity for these long-dated perpetual royalties in our portfolio. Thanks so much for your time.
And ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.